on WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, March 13. The Florida Attorney General threatened Tampa's mayor with removal over police sanctuary policies. Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer accused Tampa's Mayor Jane Castor and the Tampa Police Department of, quote, undermining state law in regards to immigration enforcement. In an open letter to Castor published on social media, Uthmeyer claimed the mayor was forcing the Tampa Police Department to use, quote, sanctuary policies that were interfering with cooperation agreements of local law enforcement agencies with ICE. Uthmeyer claims that under Castor's direction, Tampa police were not disclosing information on immigration backgrounds of certain victims and witnesses to prevent ICE from detaining and potentially deporting them. Uthmeyer demanded Castor end the use of, quote, sanctuary laws by March 31 or face consequences including potential removal of office by Governor DeSantis. Mayor Castor said in a statement Wednesday afternoon, quote, the Tampa Police Department signed the 287G and developed its immigration enforcement policy in consultation with partner agencies and law enforcement associations to ensure all immigration-related actions are carried out according to state and federal law, unquote. Castor is a former chief of police for the city of Tampa, where she served for 31 years. Under state law, 287G agreements are mandatory for all 67 Florida County jails and correctional facilities. Two Sarasota residents make Forbes Billionaires List. Forbes released its annual list of the world's billionaires, with two Sarasota locals named among the wealthiest group in the world. Businessman Kenneth Feld and real estate developer Pat Neal both made the list for 2026. Feld is the chairman of Manatee County's Feld Entertainment, the parent company of Disney on Ice and Monster Jam. The Feld family ranks among the 2,000 wealthiest people in the world, placing 1,676th on the World Billionaires list with an estimated net worth of $2.5 billion. Feld Entertainment originated out of Ringling Bros and Barnum & Bailey Circus. Pat Neal is the founder of Neal Communities, a real estate development company founded in 1970. Neal Communities has built over 25,000 homes in the Tampa Bay area. Neal first made billionaire status in 2025, with a net worth of $1.2 billion, according to Forbes. Florida lawmakers weaken but pass regulations for proposed data centers. On Wednesday, the Florida House voted 92-16 for a bill to regulate data centers after watering down the Senate's version. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has been vocal in his concerns over data center construction in the state. DeSantis spoke last month at New College of Florida, calling for increased regulation of data centers and AI companies. This represents a break from the Trump administration, who have largely supported investment in artificial intelligence, citing the need to have, quote, first dibs on the growing industry. Panama City Beach Republican Representative Griff Griffiths, sponsor of the House version of the bill, said, quote, this does not ban data centers. It simply puts guardrails in place so locals can have some controls, unquote. The House also added a requirement for the Office of Program Policy Analysis and Government Accountability to conduct an independent study on the economic and ecological impact of data centers, expected to be completed by July 2027. This has been Jackson Rothman with your WSLR news headlines for Friday, March 13th.
The following program was pre-recorded in front of an audience of one real live cat. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton, who at the music and arts venue Fogartyville provide a center for creative expression and community engagement that amplifies the voices of our diverse community and promotes peace, sustainability, democracy, and economic and social justice. I am Lou Larini, and thanks for tuning in to Surreal News, where we offer opinions, comments, and perspective on the events of the week, which do not necessarily represent the station, its board, or anyone else other than the person who expressed them. It's the second year in a row that lawmakers haven't passed the only bill that they're required to pass each year, the budget, on time. Lawmakers filed close to 1,900 bills this year, but only 86 have passed, both the House and the Senate, as of the close of legislative business by March 10th. The session officially closes today, March 13th, but there's not a lot of confidence that the House and Senate will be able to close the budgeting gap between the two bodies' proposals. The Florida Senate proposed a $115 billion budget. The House came in at lower than $113.6 billion, a difference of roughly $1.4 billion. That gap alone, for example, is enough to fund the educational costs for roughly 150,000 public school students for a year, according to previously released budget information, or pay for the resurfacing of 1,000 to 2,500 miles of 2 to 4 lane roads. But among the bills being considered, it seems the focus is more on preventing things from happening than legislation that encourages improvements in communities. Stay tuned to hear more details about bills in the pipeline that would ban any community from passing regulations aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions in any way, or another stroke of brilliance that would ban any community from instituting regulations that promoted anything that could be construed as diversity, equity, or inclusion. Florida House passed a bill last week, if made into law, could stop local governments from setting specific goals to reduce planet warming emissions. For example, Miami-Dade County set some bold targets in 2021 to cut emissions 50% by 2030 and by 2050 to reach net zero, which means balancing the county's human-caused pollution with what gets removed from the atmosphere. The new law would prevent local governments from passing any resolution, ordinance, rule, code, or policy that promotes net zero goals. It also prohibits requiring assessments, fees, and penalties to reach those goals. Counties won't be able to partner with organizations that set emission targets either. The bill analysis calls net zero policies detrimental to the energy security and economic interests of the state. Not all policies addressing emissions would be affected. If the policy also promotes cost savings, it could be fine. For example, energy efficiency programs for solar panels won't be in violation of the net zero bill. Miami-Dade County's Department of Environmental Resources said in a statement the measure would introduce additional administrative requirements that could delay or discourage projects aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions, even when providing clear economic benefits. Requiring local government to file yearly statements certifying they are not adopting or supporting net zero policies adds red tape, according to DERM. Measures like these may limit the county's ability to protect both our residents and our local economy, they wrote in a statement to the Herald. During the bill's question and answer period, Rep. Anam Eskamani, Democrat from Orlando, asked whether it was just a wording change or if policies or programs that incidentally reduce carbon but are justified by cost savings or resiliency would still be allowed. The sponsor, Bernie Jacques, said the policies focused on energy efficiency would be allowed, but if local governments tried to require or favor a single energy source, it would be a violation. For instance, the county couldn't ban natural gas in buildings or mandate using 100% renewable energy. The bill analysis specifically calls out Doral's citywide integrated sustainability plan, which aims to reduce emissions by 2050, though preserving green spaces, enhancing public transportation, and creating energy efficiency standards for buildings and transportation as example. The analysis also highlights the South Florida Climate Compact collaboration between Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, and Monroe counties, created to align the region's policies and climate goals. Part of its work includes collecting and sharing data on emissions, energy use, and climate risks so counties can make informed decisions. If passed, the bill would stop the group from setting targets to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to net zero. Letitia Harmon, Senior Director of Policy Research at Florida Rising, called the bill regressive to the region's progress. "We would like local government to have the power to do everything they need to protect their air and water," she said. Vague language and pile of carve-outs that anti-DIA bills caused one lawmaker to note needing so many exceptions to the rule may mean it's a bad rule. The Florida House has approved legislation that would ban local governments from funding, promoting, or taking official actions related to diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives. The House voted mostly along party lines, 77 to 37, to approve SB 1134. Republican reps Chip LaMarca, Hillary Casale, Will Robinson, Paula Stark, and Jim Moody joined all of the Democrats in opposing the measure. The Senate approved the bill last week and will be now sent to Governor Ron DeSantis for consideration. The measure is sponsored by Rep. Dean Black, Republican from Jacksonville. He said that over the past decade, DEI has divided society into competing factions. Not only have millions and millions of taxpayer dollars been wasted in the name of DEI, this philosophy has fostered resentment instead of goodwill, mediocrity instead of merit, and has divided our society against itself, Black told House members in introducing the bill. Black's bill defines DEI as any effort to manipulate or otherwise influence the composition of employees with reference to race, color, sex, ethnicity, gender identity, or sexual orientation, other than to ensure that hiring is conducted in accordance with state and federal anti-discrimination laws. Throughout the committee process in both chambers of the legislature, Democrats in Tallahassee and locally elected officials across the state have criticized the proposal as including vague and unclear standards about what would be a violation of the law and the penalties attached. The bill says locally elected officials who violate the ban on DEI commit malfeasance or malfeasance in office, which the state law says could lead to the governor removing them from office. It also says that a local resident can bring an action in the state trial court against a local government official who violates the bill. If found in violation by the court, that local official would have to pay legal damages to that citizen. Rep. Ashley Gant, a Democrat of Miami, said there were now about 12 carve-outs for local governments in the bill, but that didn't mean that officials would be able to understand them. She introduced an amendment providing a description of what DEI is and would be allowed under the legislation. Democratic Rep. Christine Huskowski from Parkland said the amendment was needed because it's very hard to get straight answers from the sponsor. I tried in committee, she said, but it could mean that you couldn't have an immigrant heritage month. It could mean you can't have a proclamation for Jamaican Independence Day, or you could be removed from office. It could mean that you couldn't celebrate Women's History Month or Women's Equality Day or Diwali or Chinese New Year or Easter. This is insane, she said. And if you want to talk about wasting tax dollars, I would argue that this discussion is a waste of tax dollars. If we have to make so many exceptions to the rule, perhaps the rule is the problem. Republicans rejected Gant's amendment. Another amendment filed by Rep. Michelle Gaynor, a Democrat from St. Petersburg, would ensure that local government involvement with pride events would not be in violation of the bill. That, too, went down in defeat, as did all of the 10 amendments Democrats offered. Among the carve-outs listed in the bill are allowing counties to recognize federal and state holidays and special observances, recognizing the individuals and groups honored by state monuments, memorials, and museums or national monuments and memorials, including recognizing the events and individuals forming the basis for such monuments and memorials. It would allow local governments to issue even event permits in content-neutral manner and provide public safety services. As was the case last week in the Senate, Democrats expressed strong opinions against the proposal. This bill would create major problems, said Rep. Marjorie Woodson, Democrat from Marie Woodson, Democrat from Hollywood. It tells our marginalized communities that their struggles do not matter. By banning DEI initiatives, we are closing the door on understanding and compassion. And those are crucial elements for a thriving society. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Mid-state counties are preparing for the threatened redistricting. In Central Florida, residents, local officials, and activists in the Democratic-held Florida's 9th Congressional District are preparing for a potential shakeup if they become entangled in the national battle over control of the U.S. House. The majority Hispanic district, which encompasses Osceola County and parts of Orange and Polk counties, is one of several Democratic seats in Florida that may be targeted for redistricting by Republicans in a special session in April sought by Governor Ron DeSantis. The district is represented by U.S. Rep. Darren Soto, a fourth-term Democrat and first Floridian of Puerto Rican descent to serve in Congress. Democrats in the district say any move to change its borders or push them out or add more Republicans is unfair and wrong, while members of the GOP believe they would be better represented if there's a change in their favor. States typically redistrict once a decade to account for population chambers over the decennial sentence. Florida completed the process in 2022. Mid-decade redistricting is rare, and this year's move to do so is largely perceived as partisan maneuver to maintain Republican control of Congress before the midterms. Republicans had already targeted Soto's seat as one to flip, regardless of whether it is redistricted. Responding to President Donald Trump's call for Republican-led states to redraw their congressional districts, similar efforts in California would flip 5 Republican-held seats in regions like Central Valley, Sacramento, and San Diego to Democrats. Florida's most recent maps faced criticism in 2022 for eliminating a predominantly black district in North Florida and unseating one of the state's few black representatives. The state's highest court upheld the map after legal challenges. Republicans ultimately gained 4 seats for 20 out of 28 total. Federal law, the Voting Rights Act of 1965, prohibits racial gerrymandering. It protects minority districts from being diluted in such a way that would unseat their representatives. The law was intended to more fairly give candidates of color a way into office. In Florida, the Fair Districts Amendment, which voters passed in 2010, wrote into the state's constitution a ban on political gerrymandering, too. No appointment, plan, or district shall be drawn with the intent to favor or disfavor a political party or incumbent. The state Supreme Court ruled last year, watered down the provisions, but didn't eliminate them. The U.S. Supreme Court is expected to rule this year on whether federal law will remain in place. If the court strikes down the law DeSantis wrote on X, the decision will necessitate redistricting in Florida. DeSantis, who announced in January that the legislature would hold a special session to address redistricting after lawmakers wrap up the regular session in mid-March, said redistricting will help ensure their state's growing population is represented fairly and constitutionally. Critics said it amounts to partisan gerrymandering and that redrawing maps so close to November congressional elections will sow confusion among voters. Florida's redistricting efforts already drew a lawsuit from 2 residents claiming DeSantis's plan was unconstitutional. The Florida Supreme Court shot down the petition on February 27th, saying DeSantis is allowed to call the special session. Soto's offer to office declined to make him available for an interview, but pointed to social media statements calling the plan cheating and an awful attack on our country. Cheaters got to cheat, Soto pointed on X in January. His DeSantis's plan is to violate Florida Constitution at the last minute, jam the courts. Will the legislature and the courts go along with injustice? DeSantis's office did not respond to an email request for comment. work requirements for Medicaid recipients are being considered. The One Big Beautiful Bill Act imposed Medicaid work requirements on low-income, single-list, childless adults who qualify for the program through the Affordable Care Act, often referred to as Obamacare. The Florida Senate wants to go even further this week and pass legislation, SB 1758, putting work requirements on about 1,100 of the poorest people in the state who rely on the health care safety net program for their care. Because Florida didn't expand Medicaid as allowable by the ACA, none of those 1,100 people are required to work under the federal law. The state's 80 hours of work per month and education requirements to maintain Medicaid payments are not in the House companion bill, one of several differences between the proposals that the chambers hope can be hammered out before the end of the week, the scheduled end of the 60-day session. But time is running short, and even bill sponsor Don Gates, Republican from Crestview, acknowledged that passing the measure is an uphill battle. Work requirements have been criticized by critics who note that the Florida Medicaid income eligibility limits are so low that even working just 80 hours a month at a minimum wage would jeopardize their benefits. Specifically, the state's inclusion of Medicaid work reporting requirements in SB 1758 is a misguided decision that would push thousands more Floridians into the coverage gap, including very low-income mothers, former foster children, and young adults, the Florida Policy Institute said in a prepared statement. The organization noted that the specific inclusion for terminally ill hospice patients from having to work applies only to those with the prognosis of 6 months or less to live. The group said the exemption is an indication of the bill's underlying cruelness, putting the onus on people facing end-of-life decisions to prove they're dying quickly enough to keep their Medicaid coverage. Senate Democrats tried unsuccessfully to amend SB 1758 so that the work requirements wouldn't take effect until the Florida legislature agrees to expand Medicaid under the federal ACA. Florida is one of only 10 states not to expand the program to low-income childless adults. Similarly, the Senate, the House debated Medicaid expansion last week in its version of the measure HB 693, but that effort fell short. Florida Voices for Health Executive Director Scott Darius told the Florida Phoenix it makes sense the House didn't embrace the Medicaid work requirement, given the chamber's position on the issue in the past. Darius, former House Speaker Richard Corcoran dismissed the idea of work requirements in 2018. Florida's Medicaid program serves mostly children, seniors, and single pregnant women. Corcoran said at the time, placing work requirements on those groups of people isn't something he thought the state should do. Darius said the legislative chamber is willing to accept this truth and listen to the real needs of working Floridians, will be the one to defeat the measure that go beyond federal law. In addition to the Medicaid work requirement, the bill would require more people who receive food assistance benefits through the Supplemental Nutritional and Assistance Program, or SNAP, to work to take work or take education training. Florida law already places work requirements on people through age 59. The bill would extend requirements to people through age 65. Ultimately, SB 1758 would be costly to the state and create new administrative hurdles for Republicans already struggling to make their ends meet, worsen health care outcomes for small populations of parents receiving Medicaid, and increase food insecurity, FPI said in a statement. The House bill also places work requirements on SNAP beneficiaries. While the House bill did not contain the Medicaid work requirements, that measure would defund Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood provision isn't in the Senate bill. funding for parks is facing a shortfall. A coalition of 32 groups and businesses have written a letter calling upon Florida state-led lawmakers to step up funding for repairs to the Florida state park system. The House and Senate have both requested $25 million in their 2026-2027 budget bills for repairs to state parks. A small down payment on the $759 million needed over the next decade to repair, maintain, and upgrade park projects on the state park system, according to a December 2025 report from the Department of Environmental Protection. At that pace, they contend it would take 30 years to fill that gap. Ron DeSantis requested $50 million in his proposed 2026-27 budget. There is money at hand to spend on park facility and accessibility improvements, reads a portion of the letter. The statutory uncommitted funds in the Land Acquisition Trust Fund are projected to be $824.7 million for the coming fiscal year. And in fact, the uncommitted funding is going up to $30 million compared to the previous fiscal year. As such, budgeting at least $100 million for state park facility improvements and $20 million specifically for accessibility upgrades to comply with the Americans with Disability Act is entirely feasible. The FDEP report says that funding is needed to repair aging infrastructure, safety improvements, accessibility upgrades, and modernization of essential facilities such as restrooms, trails, utilities, and visitor centers. The report was required under the 2025 State Park Preservation Act. This was the legislative response to the backlash that erupted across the state in the summer of 2024 following a report that the DeSantis administration planned to build golf courses and other amenities at 9 state parks. Florida has now 176 state parks. The most recent open is the Shoal River Headwaters State Park, a 2,480-acre site near Defunken Springs in Walton County that opened in January of 2026. Another anti-abortion doctor is being named to the Medical Regulating Board. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has appointed yet another anti-abortion doctor to the State Board of Medicine. But Dr. John Littell doesn't only oppose abortion, he opposes birth control. At a state Senate committee hearing last week, Littell, who lost his American Board of Family Medicine certification for spreading COVID misinformation, said that young women are being stripped of their fertility by hormonal birth control. He also claimed birth control has done more damage to women than any single drug ever created by mankind. It confirmed Littell will join a 15-person board that already has quite a few anti-abortion members. Dr. Stephen Christie, for example, is the author of the 32nd Pro-Life Rebuttals to Pro-Choice Articles. And Dr. Hector Villa served as a witness for the state in a suit for Florida's waiting period. Villa is a pediatric anesthesiologist, so it is unclear how his expertise was warranted. Why is this important? The state medical board creates rules for physicians and can discipline doctors. That means DeSantis can weaponize them against healthcare providers. To me, though, this appointment is all about Republicans' broad and sneaky war on contraception. The GOP doesn't need to make birth control outright illegal. If they can just keep chipping away at the access or stacking influential boards and agencies with extremist maniacs. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. The latest tranche of released Epstein files indicated, although not proven, an allegation against the president. President Trump allegedly sexually assaulted a 13-year-old girl who was trafficked to him by Jeffrey Epstein, according to documents released by the Department of Justice last week. The White House insists the allegations are completely baseless and backed by zero credible evidence. For three decades, the victim only told her mother and one close friend about the alleged assault by Trump. The DOJ became aware of the allegation when that friend called a tip line that had been set up for Epstein victims. But that time, her mother was deceased. In 2019, the victim told the FBI that her mother advertised her babysitting services at Hilton Head, South Carolina in 1980s. She was 13 years old. Epstein, known to her as Jeff, responded. She said when she arrived at Epstein's condo, he was alone and offered her drugs and alcohol. As the room went blurry, the victim alleged Epstein began to sexually assault her. She said the rapes and abuse continued for several years, both in South Carolina and other states. When she was between 13 and 15 years old, the victim said she was transported by Epstein to either New York or New Jersey and taken to a very tall building with huge rooms. At that point, according to her account, she was introduced to Donald Trump. The victim told the FBI that Trump cleared the room and said something like, "Let me teach you how little girls are supposed to be." Trump then unzipped his pants and forced her head onto his penis, the victim alleged. In her FBI interview, the victim said that she bit the shit out of it, and in response, Trump retaliated by hitting her on the side of the head. Since the initial release of the documents, two important developments have bolstered the credibility of the alleged victim. This new information has received little national attention. First, the Miami Herald's Julie K. Brown, the nation's premier journalist on the Epstein scandal, has revealed new information about how the FBI pressed the victim. Brown, citing a DOJ source reporting that FBI agents who interviewed the victim found her to be credible. The DOJ source told Brown that they would not have interviewed her four times if they suspected she was lying. This does not mean they were able to verify the substance of the victim's allegations, but it is significant. Second, the Post and Courier, a media outlet based in Charleston, South Carolina, verified key aspects of the victim's story around the time of the alleged Trump assault. For example, the victim claimed her mother had become aware that Epstein had nude photos of the teen from their sexual encounters and demanded money to keep them hidden. She told the FBI that this extortion demand caused her mother to steal funds from her real estate company. The Post and Courier obtained public records showing that the mother was accused of stealing $22,000 from the escrow account at the time. The victim also said that these financial crimes ultimately landed her mother in a state prison near Columbia. Public records obtained by the Post and Courier confirmed her mother's incarceration. Smaller details also checked out. For example, the victim said that the DOJ that she once bumped into Epstein at a Rick James concert in Savannah. Archival newspaper databases show that James regularly played in the Savannah area at the time. These new developments do not prove the substance of the victim's allegations is true, but put into context with what we already knew about Trump and how Epstein files have been handled, it suggests her claims should be taken seriously. Three key documents about Trump's alleged sexual assault of a minor were withheld. On January 30th, the DOJ announced that it had completed the release of all Epstein documents and it was required to disclose under the Epstein Files Transparency Act. That document dump, however, only included a brief description of the allegations against Trump and a summary of one interview where the victim did not discuss the alleged sexual assault by Trump. independent journalist Roger Solenberger discovered the existence of three additional interview summaries with the victim in the files of the case involving Ghislaine Maxwell. Solenberger's reporting was later confirmed by numerous major media outlets. Only after a public outcry about the missing files were summaries of these interviews released. Other key documents about Trump's alleged sexual assault of a minor continued to be withheld. NPR reported that 53 pages of material related to Trump's alleged sexual assault of a minor were excluded from the DOJ's January 30th release. So far, only 16 pages have been disclosed, meaning 37 pages are still being withheld from pages are still being withheld by the Trump administration. The missing documents include notes from the interviews, a law enforcement report, and license records. The DOJ has not explained why these materials are not being released. More than two dozen women have accused Trump of sexual assault. In 2023, a jury found Trump liable for sexually abusing writer E. Jean Carroll in the mid-90s and later defaming her. He was accused by multiple contestants of walking into group dressing rooms while teenagers were changing their clothes during the Miss Teen USA pageants in the 1990s. In 2005, he bragged about his ability to go into beauty pageant dressing rooms during an episode of Howard Stern. Famously, Trump was recorded bragging about his ability to get away with sexual assaults in 2005 on an Access Hollywood tape. The Epstein Ranch in New Mexico is getting more attention. Authorities in New Mexico launched a search this week of a sprawling ranch formerly owned by convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, which has come under renewed interest after allegations surrounding the estate were included in files recently released by the U.S. Justice Department. The New Mexico Department of Justice announced this week search of the property known as Zorro Ranch in a brief statement posted to its website. It is part of a criminal investigation announced by state authorities last month into allegations of illegal activities surrounding the ranch at the time Epstein, who died in 2019, owned it. The statement did not indicate whether anything of interest has been found during the search or how long it is expected to continue. The ranch had previously not been subject to the same level of law enforcement scrutiny as Epstein's other properties in New York, South Florida, and the Caribbean. But following the release of troves of federal government files related to Epstein, New Mexico Attorney General Raul Torres ordered the reopening of the state's criminal investigation into the property, which he said closed in 2019 at the request of federal prosecutors. Included in the millions of files released by the Justice Department in late January was a 2019 email received by a local radio host that alleged that somewhere in the hills outside Zorro, two foreign girls were buried on the orders of Jeffrey and Madam G. That allegation was unverified, but is also not clear to what extent it had been investigated by law enforcement before the recent renewed interest in Epstein. The host, Eddie Aragon, previously told CNN that he believed the email was sent to him by someone who worked on the ranch but would not disclose who he thought the person was. He said he tried sending an email to the address, but it bounced back. The files show he forwarded the allegations to a redacted email address 4 days after receiving it. The radio host added that he went to the local FBI office with the email and forwarded it to a local FBI agent. Following the reopening of the state investigation, Aragon told CNN this week that he reached out to the New Mexico Department of Justice and had an approximately 30-minute interview. The release of the email sent to Aragon prompted Stephanie Garcia-Richard, New Mexico's Commissioner of Public Lands to send a letter last month asking the State Department of Justice to investigate the claims. She told CNN in February that the Special Investigation Office of the New Mexico DOJ later reached out to her for background information on state lands and her agency's processes and documents it released in 2019. Apart from the criminal inquiry, the state's House of Representatives last month voted to create a bipartisan truth commission looking into allegations of criminal activity surrounding the ranch. The commission has the power to issue subpoenas and compel attendance of witnesses to hearings. The property now owned by the family of Don Huffines, a businessman and former Texas senator who was running for state comptroller. Huffines previously said he would cooperate with any law enforcement investigation surrounding the ranch. The New Mexico Department of Justice said in its statement that owners and staff are cooperating with the search. Authorities asked members of the public to stay away from the ranch, which is in a remote area about 30 miles south of Santa Fe, to avoid interfering with law enforcement. Funding for AIDS and HIV meds is being cut, and it's costing lives. The cornerstone of the effort to combat the nation's HIV epidemic is beginning to show fiscal cracks. The Ryan White AIDS Drug Assistance Program has helped more than a quarter of a million Americans living with HIV to get life-saving medications, health insurance, or both. But funding pressure has prompted 18 states to cut costs, jeopardizing care for thousands of Americans living with HIV, according to an analysis by the health policy nonprofit KFF. Another five states considering changes to stretch out limited funding for Ryan White assistance programs, known as ADAPs, KFF said. As these states have enacted or are considering changes, some experts worry more states could follow. Not only do program cuts harm the portion of the 1.2 million Americans living with HIV, it could get sicker without the viral-suppressing medications and transmit the virus to others. We're worried about all states, said Tim Horn, Director of Medication Access for the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors. Sometimes it seems budget deficits appear out of thin air. The federally funded Ryan White HIV/AIDS program provides money to state-based ADAPs to pay for medications and insurance for people with HIV. ADAPs also receive state funding and other sources of revenue, such as drug rebates. The National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Direction and KFF said several factors pressuring state-based ADAP programs. HIV medication and health insurance costs have soared, straining state programs. These programs have also experienced a surge of people seeking assistance. Meanwhile, congressional funding for Ryan White programs has been flat in recent years. In 2024, these state programs served more than 257,000, a jump from 30% in 2022, according to figures from the National Alliance of State and Territorial AIDS Directors. The programs mainly served lower-income populations. Nearly one in four people with HIV get services from ADAP programs. Horn said that the enrollment surge came when the federal government resumed Medicaid eligibility checks that were suspended during COVID-19 pandemic. HIV patients who no longer qualified for Medicare turned to state ADAPs to pay for medication, insurance, or both. Other federal insurance policy changes further squeezed ADAPs. Congress did not extend the Affordable Care Act's enhanced subsidies and lowered consumers' spending on insurance plans. ACA plans became more expensive this year, and consumers' average insurance costs spiked 114%. Because of the experience of enhanced tax credits, according to a KFF analysis. More pressure is on the horizon. President Donald Trump's tax cut and spending legislation is projected to trim more than $900 billion in federal spending on Medicaid over the next decade. The law's changes could leave millions of Americans uninsured over that time period, according to estimates from the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. Florida enacted changes that are expected to cut off assistance for an estimated 10,000 to 16,000 residents. Florida sharply reduced income limits for the program. Florida previously extended eligibility to people who earned up to 400% of the federal poverty level, or $63,840 a year. Now Florida cuts off residents who earn more than 130% of the federal poverty level, or $20,748 per year. Florida's program will also no longer cover Biktarvy, the most widely prescribed HIV drug. A one-month supply of the drug for those without insurance costs an average of $5,132, according to GoodRx. The Florida Department of Health said the program changes were needed to prevent a budget gap of more than $120 million. Florida's changes are probably the most severe, but other states are cutting back on income eligibility, said Jennifer Cates, Senior Vice President and Director of the Global Public Health Policy at KFF. You're listening to WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. Another unproven remedy to a devastating condition has been promoted by the White House. The Food and Drug Administration this week approved a generic medication for a rare brain disorder while walking back suggestions by President Donald Trump and other administration officials that the drug showed great promise for people with autism. The agency said it approved Leucovorin for children and adults with genetic condition that limits delivery of folate, a form of vitamin B, to the brain. FDA officials estimate that the ultra-rare condition impacts fewer than 1 in 1 million people in the U.S. It's a major step back from statements made at a White House news conference in September when Trump and FDA Commissioner Marty McCarry announced that the drug was under review to benefit patients with autism, some of whom have a form of vitamin brain deficiency. It might be 20, 40, 50% of kids with autism, McCarry said at the news conference. The White House event followed promises from Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to determine the cause of autism by September. But senior FDA officials told reporters that their review was narrowed to focus on the strongest evidence, which only supported the drugs used by patients with the rare mutagen that impacts folate levels in the brain. The FDA officials also pointed out that one study supporting the drug's use for autism was retracted earlier this year. Leucovorin is a synthetic metabolite of folate, which is essential for healthy pregnancies and is recommended for women before conception and during pregnancy. The drug's current FDA label covers Leucovorin's use in reducing side effects of certain chemotherapy drugs and treating a rare blood disorder. Patients affected by the condition targeted by Tuesday's approval experience moments of disorder, seizures, and other neurological problems that can resemble symptoms of autism. But professional medical societies say it's far from clear whether the drug helps people with autism. The American Academy of Pediatrics doesn't recommend routine use of Leucovorin for autistic children, including those with a brain condition known as cerebral folate deficiency. Some trials in the subset of patients suggest potential benefit, the group states, but research comes from small-scale studies. Unresolved questions about the drug haven't stopped U.S. doctors from prescribing it. A paper published in The Lancet last week found that levoquorin prescriptions for children aged 5 to 17 were 71% higher than normal in the 3 months immediately following Trump's late September news conference. And families of children with autism have reported trouble getting prescriptions filled in recent weeks. FDA officials told reporters the agency is allowing imports of the drug by former foreign drug makers to help boost supply. The drug's original manufacturer, GSK, does not plan to relaunch its version of the drug. Trump officials originally decided to review the drug after speaking with an Arizona-based neurologist who prescribes the drug for autism patients and runs an online education business focused on the experimental treatment. The theory behind the drug's use is that some people with autism have specific antibodies that block folate from entering the brain. But the Autism Science Foundation and other groups note that non-autistic relatives of people with the disorder often have the same antibodies, suggesting they're not a factor in the condition. While there's no single cause behind autism, most researchers say science points to genetic and environmental factors as playing a role. Former D.C. District Attorney has been charged with an ethics violation. The office that enforces ethics standards for attorneys in the nation's capital has accused Justice Department official Ed Martin of professional misconduct for a threatening letter that he sent to Georgetown Law School's dean last year when Martin was the top federal prosecutor for Washington, D.C. Martin was the interim U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia when he warned the Georgetown dean that his office wouldn't hire the private school's students if it didn't eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, according to the ethics charges filed last week by the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. Martin, an ardent Trump loyalist who is now the Justice Department's pardon attorney, is accused of violating his oath of office and the Constitution's right to free speech and due process. Disciplinary counsel Hamilton Fox, who filed the ethics charges against Martin, is asking a panel of D.C. Court of Appeals officials to decide if any discipline is warranted. Martin and an attorney representing him in the matter didn't immediately respond to emails seeking comment. Martin has 20 days to formally respond in writing. After Martin learned of the accusations against him last year, he sent a letter addressed to the D.C. Court of Appeals judges in which he complained about Fox's uneven behavior and requested a face-to-face meeting with all of you to discuss this matter and find a way forward, according to Fox's filings. Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche criticized the complaint against Martin as a product of a blatantly Democrat-run political organization. A Justice Department statement said that the complaint fits a partisan organization agenda to punish Trump administration officials while ignoring ethical lapses by government attorneys who worked under Democratic presidents Joe Biden and Barack Obama. Let us not forget that D.C. barred members of Biden's special counsel were found to have acted against Donald Trump without legal authority and in clear violation of the Constitution, yet the bar did nothing, the department statement said. Martin was a conservative activist with no prosecutorial experience when President Donald Trump picked him last January to lead the nation's largest U.S. attorney's office. Martin was a leading figure in Trump's Stop the Steal movement after the 2020 presidential election. In a letter to Georgetown Law Dean Wilm Trentnor last February, Martin said a whistleblower informed him that the Georgetown Law School continues to promote and teach DEI. The letter dovetailed with an executive order that Trump signed to call for ending DEI programs in the federal government. This is unacceptable, Martin wrote, warning the dean that his office wouldn't consider any Georgetown law students for jobs, summer internships, or fellowships until his letter of inquiry was resolved. In response, Trentnor told Martin that the First Amendment prohibits the government from dictating what Georgetown's faculty teaches or how to teach it. Given the First Amendment protections of a university's freedom to determine its own curriculum and how to deliver it, the constitutional violation behind this threat is clear, as is the attack on the university's mission, as a Jesuit and Catholic institution trainer wrote. Trump pulled Martin's nomination to keep the job on a more permanent basis after a key Republican senator said he could not support Martin for the job due to his outspoken advocacy for Trump supporters who stormed the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Last May, Trump picked Fox News host Jeanine Pirro to replace Martin as U.S. attorney. Martin remains in the Justice Department's as the Justice Department's pardon attorney, but was recently removed as head of its weaponization working group, which is tasked with scrutinizing the federal prosecutions of Trump. Cruise ship port in Manatee County appears to be a dead deal. The House has approved a bill aiming to promote nature-based coastal protection strategies while strengthening safeguards for aquatic preserves, including provisions designed to block a developer-proposed cruise port in Manatee County. Lawmakers approved SB 302 from Miami Republican Senator Elena Garcia via a 109-0 vote. In Manatee County, the bill adds protections for the Teresia Aquatic Preserve, introduced as an amendment by Bradenton Republican Senator Jim Boyd. The amendment prohibits the dredging or filling of submerged lands there, except under limited circumstances, such as public navigation projects, public health needs, or environmental restoration efforts. The overall legislation seeks to boost coastal protection strategies that rely on natural systems, including mangrove planting, oyster reef restoration, dune and wetland rehabilitation, and wave attenuation devices, either alone or combined with traditional infrastructure like seawalls. The bill also directs the Department of Environmental Protection to develop clear statewide standards for nature-based coastal protection methods by 2027, including living shorelines, seagrass restoration, and other hybrid green-gray infrastructures. Protections for the Teresia match protections for Biscayne Bay Aquatic Preserve in Miami, which are also refined by SB 302. Modifications to the Biscayne Bay protections allow certain restoration and shoreline stabilization projects, including living shorelines and vegetation plantings, when beneficial for coastal resiliency and environmental quality improvement efforts. In addition to regulatory changes, the measure directs state and local government to promote public awareness and education about the benefits of nature-based coastal protection methods. Key Largo Republican Rep. Jim Mooney represented the Senate version of the measure, and it was ultimately approved by the House without amendments. He told representatives this week the bill strengthens Florida's ability to protect its coastlines by promoting the use of nature-based solutions that work with natural systems to protect Florida shorelines. Bradenton Republican Rep. Will Robinson voiced his support for the measure, highlighting the added protections for the Teresia Aquatic Preserve. Robinson and Boyd have long worked together to protect the Teresia ecosystem and were quick to publicly oppose the cruise port proposal. "It's one of the most pristine areas in our state, and we don't need mega cruise ships in the area," Robinson said. "Your bill will do a great deal towards stopping that from occurring in one of the most important environmental areas in the state. Thank you for agreeing to put that language in. It's a wonderful bill and maybe of more important environmental bills we vote on this session." The measure will head to the governor's office for final approval. If signed, the legislation would take effect July 1st. The past friendship between President Donald Trump and Jeffrey Epstein was memorialized once again last week after an anonymous artist group erected a 12-foot statue in Washington, D.C. to honor the bond between the two, and in the style of the 1997 hit film Titanic. As reported by local CBS affiliate WUSA 9, the statue was erected at the National Mall across from the Capitol and came from the same group that erected another statue last year, honoring Trump and Epstein's past friendship. The latest Trump-Epstein statue is titled King of the World and depicts the two